Hello everyone, Bruce Edwin here with HollywoodSentinel.com, and I have today with us, folks, a very person, very important and special to me, and that is one of, in my view, one of the greatest cinematographers in the world, just really a phenomenal, just a legend in the world of filmmaking and cinematography, and that is Anthony Richmond. Anthony, hello, sir.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Anthony, it's just such an honor. I have to say, I was so excited to meet you. I didn't know you were going to be in person a few weeks back when I had the pleasure to meet you for the screening of One Plus One by Jean-Luc Godard, and that you, of course, did cinematography for. So thank you for being there, and it was great to meet you then.
Likewise, I'm very excited to be there. I think it was a great show. I mean, I think it's what you saw was the restoration of the movie we shot in 1967. And I think that, you know, when it came out, it wasn't particularly well received. I mean, the rock fans liked the Stone sequences, but the rest of it, the very political stuff, wasn't very well received. But I think that 50 years on, it's rather important now, because basically nothing has changed. what was going on in 1960 is still going on in 1918 and 2018 in America, with all that political stuff going on, which Godard was he was a very political animal, but I always loved his movies. And I think the great thing about the Stone sequences is that it's probably the first time anybody's really ever seen the process of a major group making a record. I think there's a lot of people that are probably not necessarily in the know of the music business, but love music. The groups go into the recording studio, do the song, go home, and mix it,
Right.
What's important about that is that song started off as one thing and progressed through and became something totally different, But I think that's what's interesting for people to see. Also, they weren't performing for us. It wasn't as if we'd hired the rock group to be in the movie and they performed for us. They were actually recording the tracks in the Revel at the time in Barnes Studio in London. And that's why we had to do very long takes and very long tracking shots, because we were basically, we were flies on the wall. We were just voyeurs to them. And I think that also comes across. You see them in a very natural state making the movie and making the song then.
Well, exactly. And I mean, there's so much I want to, I could say on that. Now, I'll try to spare all my comments because I want to hear more from you than myself. But, it's just, it really was. It was so amazing to see, as a Rolling Stones fan and rock and roll fan myself, it was just so exciting to see, cool to see that, them work on making a song and building it. And the different takes of that, and it was just so cool how you filmed it. Just to clarify, listeners, we're referring to the film One Plus One, also known as Sympathy for the Devil, about the Rolling Stones, by Jean-Luc Godard, but also, as Anthony mentioned, about so much more, because Godard fans, familiar viewers of Godard, will know he brings in so many other elements of political, apolitical, revolutionary type aspects, philosophical moments, and you captured that so well, and it really just flowed seamlessly with the distinction of both areas. It was really cool.
Well, yes, indeed. It was really exciting. First of all, I'm very young, and the plane was my second movie, and to be asked to shoot that.
Amazing.
It was fantastic, and we met in very, very weird circumstances. We asked him to do the movie, and then basically I would go to Paris every weekend, and we were to prep the movie. So we didn't prep the movie in London. And basically the only thing we really discussed, I met him every weekend, just generally, I went out Friday night, but I generally met him Sunday afternoon before I came back to London. And all the discussion wasn't about the Stones and how we were going to shoot the Stones. Because of the situation, they were really recording the movie, they were recording the song, and we were voyeurs to that, and how we would do it. As far as the rest of it was concerned, which made it really exciting for me, but probably not for the producers, was there was no script.
I can imagine.
We didn't really know what was going on. So locations were found, and we would turn up. You know, generally the car would pick me up at my house in central London, and I'd go to the hotel where Goddard was staying with my wife. And in the car, he'd show me or tell me what we were going to do that day. But there was no script.
Yeah.
There was no dialogue. And it was really fantastic. I mean, all that stuff in the streets of London where, you know, Anna momentarily gets out and starts spray painting cars and walls and billboards and hotel windows. I mean, that's real paint. And we had no permission.
Wow.
Cars. It was wonderful.
That's amazing. I was wondering about that. You know, knowing Godard, I felt that that was the case, that she was actually doing the graffiti. So that's incredible. Wow.
And then, of course, there was after we finished the movie, we obviously went back to France to edit it. And what had happened was, I guess about a week before the premiere was at I think it was going to open the London Film Festival. So there was great excitement, the Godard film, the first picture we'd shot outside France, I think, certainly the first picture we'd shot in England.
Yeah.
And, like a week before, he never came over for any of the color correction. And he called me and asked how it was. And I said, it's good. And, he said, how many prints came off? And I said, well, we did fourth print and the fifth print were married. And, the fifth print was great. And I've agreed to that. And he said, what's the fourth print like? And that was the second, that was the first married print we did.
Yeah.
And I said, it's great. There were just a couple of minor changes. Can you get hold of that?
Okay.
I think so. Now, you couldn't do this today, but all those years ago, I knew the head of the lab very well, and said, Godard, I want to see that fourth print. Can I take it to him? And they said, come and pick it up. So I called Godard, and I got the print. And he said, Simon will pick it up from you. And they did. And then during the opening night, the premiere, great excitement. And then the Inquiry and Michael Pearson, the producers got up on the stage. Ian Quarry was the Canadian actor. He was the producer with Michael Pearson. He was the one that played the dialogue in the porno bookshop in that velvet suit. And they started talking about the movie. And then there was a scream, and Jean-Luc Godard came running down the aisle, jumped up on the stage, and said, this is not my movie, it's their movie. My movie is being projected outside in the car park. He punched the Inquiry on the nose and knocked it out. He ran outside. Of course, Godard was booed. And the reason why he wasn't in the movie is, in the re-released 4K restoration, there's Symphony of the Devil and there's 1+1. And they're both exactly the same movie.
Okay.
Except what the producers have done is over the last scene in the movie with the last 8 minutes or 6 minutes of the stone is sitting on the ground, is strumming away, and it goes over the end sequence, they put the completed song of Sympathy of the Devil. Godard didn't want that. He wanted the stones were sitting on the floor just strumming. And his premise was, and I got it. I really got it then, and I get it now.
Right.
The movie is about art and destruction. In Godard's mind, art is never finished. And we also know that destruction is never finished. Destruction goes on. And had he put the completed soundtrack over the movie, it meant the Stones have finished their art and complete. Well, that doesn't make sense.
Right.
So I was on his side. So in the Blu-ray, you get both movies.
Oh, interesting. Okay, good. So, folks,
unlike what you saw in the museum here, I did a screening at MoMA in New York, and what they did, they actually showed Sympathy of the Devil, and then when that was over, they showed the last 8 minutes of 1+1.
Oh,
see the change.
Okay,
and they all loved it. And there was 300 people. They all loved 1+1 better. I mean, the director, it's his vision, it's his movie, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Now, to clarify my comment earlier, I said knowing Godard that it doesn't surprise me that he actually had her doing real graffiti. I don't know Godard, you know, personally, but I'm just a big fan of his work, and really just a fan of your work, Anthony, from being reminded recently of all the films you've done. I want to get into more of that in a minute, but, you know, it's... I know you've said it was great working with Godard, and I just, you know... What was, you said he had no script, and it was just your second film. That's just unbelievable.
We sort of made that when we were along. It was wonderful. There was a great sense of freedom about it. I mean, the producers were insane. And
yeah.
He didn't know them at all. He did his own thing, which I must say, I love very much.
Well, that's
and
great.
I did like him. And also, you know, he was a hero. And still is today, one of my favorite films is Alcatraz.
Yes. Yes.
And I just think that was so new wave at the time. It was so spot on. You know?
Exactly.
Fantastic.
Exactly. You know, I need to go and re-see that. I saw it when I was, you know, many years ago. Now you've worked. Yeah, pardon me. You've worked with another one of my favorite directors, François Truffaut. I've read Fahrenheit 51.
Yeah, I was assistant cameraman of Fahrenheit 51.
Assistant cameraman.
Amazing.
That's incredible. Tell us about that, please, because Truffaut is another legend, obviously.
Well, yeah, he's totally different. Totally different to Godard. I mean, he was a more traditional story. It was a more traditional script. I mean, he had a script. He was just a gentle, kind, sweet man, and the British couldn't love him. You know, and he was just a didn't scream, didn't shout, and an unbelievable sense of humor. It was just wonderful. You know?
Wow. That's so.
Oscar Werner in that movie wasn't very nice to Truffaut, but he was a big star. And it was rather sad because Truffaut made him a star in Jules Lynch, you know.
Incredible. Incredible. Well, that's so amazing. I'm sure you have so many stories. Now, I want to jump into a bit of your work in the music. And when I said, listeners, when I mentioned, you know, Anthony Richmond having the honor to speak to, being one of the most important cinematographers I don't think that's even disputed. I think just from a musical standpoint, as a lover of rock music myself, you know, and I started a rock magazine in college, you've worked with Rolling Stones, with, you know, obviously 1+1, Rock and Roll Circus. Now, I want to jump into that in a minute. With Rolling Stones, you worked on Kids, you did cinematography for the Kids Are All Right, with The Who, The Man Who Fell to Earth, with David Bowie, The Beat Goes On, with Sonny and Cher. I mean, so much. It's how did this work begin for you in the music scene, and what was that like? I know that's a big question, but it's just phenomenal to me.
How it became is that the very first picture I shot in 1967 was a movie called Only When I Laugh, and it was a comedy. Strange enough, it was written by Len Dayton, who wrote Give Chris Farrell and all those spy novels, you know, a great writer, Len, but he wrote this comedy. It's a caper movie, and he shot it in New York, Beirut, and London, and starred David Hemmings as the huge star in those days.
Yeah.
So when the movie was completed, you know, all that happened is they would do the title. In those days, when you wanted visual titles, you generally hired a title company to go out and do them.
Sure.
Which they did. They hired a small company in London that did titles and had a director, and then they decided they thought that as we were using the actors in the titles, they should get the DP and shoot them. And so I shot these titles for 3 days with a director, a young American director who lived in London called Michael D.C. Hogg. And Michael was... doing a big television rock and roll show in those days, and something like Ready, Steady, Go, which was huge.
I've heard of that. Never, yeah.
And all the major groups would be on it one way or another.
Okay.
And just at the end of this 3-day shoot, we got on very well, and he said, "What are you doing next weekend?" I said, "I mean, I'm going to do a video with the Rolling Stones. You want to do it?" I said, "Sure." So we did Jumping Jack Flash.
Oh, wow.
And that was my first thing with the Stones. And Michael and I got on really well.
Amazing.
And then he said, you know, I'm going to do something with the Stones called the Rock and Roll Circus. I went to a meeting with him and Alan Klein, who was the Stones manager. and we did this, we planned out this this show. We obviously shot in a studio in the outskirts of London, and we bought in a really strange little tiny circus, the arena there. All the strange acts with the lady on the horse kept falling off, and people on the trapeze running like 3 feet off the ground, that sort of stuff.
And yeah.
Interspersed with all these groups, and it really is a. We just completed a 4K restoration of that, and it's the 50th anniversary on December the 11th, and I think the Universal, who own the music for that, are flying me to London to do a Q&A and screen, but I'm not sure. I'll know this afternoon on Monday morning. But anyway, that's coming out after Christmas.
Excellent.
What's great about it is that it's got Taj Mahal, Jethro Tull, I Am Faithful.
Wow.
They got the group they call the Dirty Mac, which is Clapton and Lennon.
Oh, wow.
And Ginger Baker and Keith Richards.
Oh, my gosh.
The Who, and the Rolling Stones. So it's a great piece of rock and roll history. That'll last forever, And that restoration is also fantastic. I just kind of couldn't get in Dolby Vision.
Oh, that's exciting. I've never seen it. I want to see it.
Oh, it's amazing. It's really amazing.
That's incredible.
And then from there, I went on and did Let It Be with the Beatles. The whole thing, not only the roof, but the whole sort of documentary of it, which was fantastic.
And
after that, I did the thing with the Who, and I guess I thought, well, maybe I don't need to do any more rock and roll. I've worked with the best, and I went on to do more features. That's how I got into all of that.
Well, that's just...
They're all, not because I did them, but they're all legendary pieces of rock music. A lot of those guys are dead now.
It really is amazing. Yeah. What was it like to? Did you have much interaction with John Lennon? What was it like dealing with?
Oh yeah, a lot of interest. Much more interaction with the Beatles than I did with the Stones. Only because we were a lot longer shooting.
So much, yeah. What was he like to you?
He was fantastic. He was fantastic. He was absolutely fantastic. He's the one I like the most. They're all great musicians. George didn't say much. George was very, very quiet. Ringo was his amiable self. And you could really see the... what was going on between Lennon and McCartney and the whole thing beginning to fall apart.
Interesting.
We remastered it and I recolor corrected it, and then they've been waiting to bring it out on Blu-ray because there's so many extras that could go in. And I believe, is that they can't change the movie because the movie was already released at one point. Even though it was only on VHS, but there's so many extras you could go in, because you see in the movie the breakup of the group and all the stuff going on between them, but there's so many extras in the DVD which would be so fantastic, with all the crazy, the contention between them all and arguments and things like that. But I'm told it's being held up by George Harrison's estate in Yoko Ono.
Oh my.
But I don't know why, because everybody knew they broke up, and everybody knew we like each other at the end, so what difference does it make,
Yeah, exactly.
That would be wonderful for the fans to see.
Well, definitely. And you've, of course, The Man Who Fell to Earth with David Bowie. I mean, there's Bowie is so legendary.
That's an amazing movie. That's really amazing movie. And it was really interesting to shoot, because, Bowie was just coming off. The original choice for Nicholas Rowe to play Michael Crichton, the author.
Okay.
Michael was very, very tall and very, very skinny. And wasn't going to do it. And then pulled out. And it looked like the movie was going to fall to pieces. And Nick had just seen that documentary on Bowie, but it was just drug period and creep period.
Yeah.
And Bowie agreed to do it. So it was really, he was perfect for it. I mean, in that movie, very weird and very weird looking, and he's very tall and he's very skinny.
Yes.
know, he was coming off of a massive amount of drugs.
Wow.
And sometimes the team is barely holding it together.
Yeah.
For me, his performance fantastic for that role. You know?
Interesting. Yeah, yeah. I saw it many years ago. Again, I need to see these films again. They're just legendary. You've done so
much. We did a big restoration of that. That's been restored. There's a new Blu-ray out of that.
Oh, that's exciting. That's excellent.
Yeah.
I'm speaking here, folks, with the legendary cinematographer Anthony Richmond. Anthony, I had the pleasure to also find out something I didn't know about you. One, that you lived here in Los Angeles, but also that you actually are here teaching. You teach cinematography at the New York Film Academy here in Los Angeles in Burbank. And that just really... Personally, as a student of cinema, that it was exciting to me.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that, you know, I came up a different way. There were no film schools really in my day, and
really?
You started at the bottom and you worked your way up, you know, and I had lots of lucky breaks, but by being in the right place at the right time. But I was really, really helped a great deal by some very influential cinematographers. I mean, like Freddie Young, you know, won Oscars for Ryan's Daughter and Lawrence of Arabia.
Wow.
Another DP called John Wilcox, who really took me under his wing. And then, of course, Nicholas Rogue, who I met in 1960 in Israel when I was on a big movie there, starring Peter Finch and Sophie Loren called Judith. And I was on the assistant camera on the first unit, and Nick was shooting and directing the second unit, and I gravitated towards him, and we became great friends, you know. And then he took me on Dr. Zhivago.
Wow.
And he got fired after a month, but I stayed on. and I didn't like David Dean being fired, my mentor, you know. And he found out that I didn't like him. So he went out of his way to be unbelievably kind to me and took me under his wing. And I learned a great deal from him, you know. So, I didn't get anywhere without a great deal of help.
When
you reach it, we reach a certain age, and movie making is very, very tough and very hard work. And I still shoot movies, and
love it.
You know, I was offered this job at New Film Academy at the Chair of Cinematography. And you know, it's like a way of giving back. You know, I have given so much. I'm trying to give back to our students. And we have an amazing Marshall Fine Arts Cinematography program. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, it's a very, very hands-on program. We shoot a great deal. All the instructors that work with me or for me are all major cinematographers, ASC members. Like I'm an ASC member, BSC member.
Of course,
Society of Cinematography member.
Yeah.
And the great thing about this school is they love their teachers to go off and do movies to keep relevant. Well, a lot of cinema schools, if you teach, you're going to teach them, that's it, you know. But we teach theory, mostly hands-on. And that's the way students learn. I mean, teach it like it is on the outside when you go to work.
Right.
Well, it's a very good program.
Well, I definitely can see that. I mean, just the fact that you're teaching there, that's just, it's hugely impressive. And I typically don't endorse any, you know, institutions or schools. But I mean, the fact that you're there and what they've got is really amazing. So you've done also, I need to bring this up because I remember being a fan of early horror films. A fan of Clive Barker's work. You did cinematography for one of the most famous horror films of all time, Candyman. And I've got to...
Fantastic movie. I love Candyman.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a cult classic now, too. I mean, what was that like for you?
Oh, it was really fantastic. I mean, it was a small independent movie, so we could sort of do what we liked. And I really love Bernard Rose. Bernard Rose, the director, has written the script. It's a fantastic script. You know, I was so excited to do that. And once again, we just this year, a few months ago, completed a 4K restoration of that. And restoration is fantastic. So that Blu-ray will be coming out in America very shortly. It's fantastic.
Well, that's exciting. I love it. That's another one I want to see again.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Like some of the stuff in Candyman, even though I shot the movie when we saw the baby jump out of my skin, you know.
Yeah, it's. I watched the trailer of it again last week, and it still looks amazing. Now, you've worked with so many, I just want to mention, I'm not going to name all your films, I'd be here, it'd take way too long, but you've worked with Donald Sutherland at least a couple times on The Eagles Have Landed with Robert Duvall, directed by the legendary John Sturges, also Don't Look Now with Donald Sutherland. What was that like working with Duvall and Sturges and Sutherland, and just legends in their own right?
Well, first of all, I worked with Sutherland before then, because Don't Look Now became before that.
Okay.
And I just heard the other day that they're doing a 4K restoration, an ultra high def digital restoration of that.
Yeah.
And they're going to re-release it in the cinemas next year.
Wow.
And that's fantastic. But that was Don't Look Now is a fantastic movie. I mean, not because I should, but it's just a fantastic movie. It's very scary, and it's a sort of some people call it a psychological horror. I think it's much more of a psychological thriller. I think many great movies of Nicholas Roeg directed, I think this to the general public is the most accessible movie, and that even though we shot in 1972. That movie is still relevant today. It's a timeless movie. It's fantastic. And Donald was great in that.
Yeah.
And after that, I did The Eagles Landed. And that was a major highlight of my career, too.
Right.
To work with John Sturges. I mean, I was very young when he did that.
It's amazing.
And John Sturges was an amazing director. I think as those great Hollywood directors go, I think he was very underrated. I don't think he got...
Agree.
He's just dudes, he's made such great movies. I mean, even Kurosawa loved The Magnificent Seven, which is a remake of movies from Cameron.
Yeah.
He did Gunfire of the O.K. Corral, Bad Day at Black Rock, that one-armed fight with Spencer Tracy is fantastic.
Exactly.
I mean,
it's legendary.
Wonderful director.
That's outstanding.
I love that.
I love your... Pardon?
I was going to say, to do about Donald, the only thing was that John Sturges, one of those guys, when we first met and we were in bed and talking, he said, listen, you can take as long as you like to light, but when you're ready, be ready, because if I like, take one,
wow,
we're going to print it and move on. That's all he said. I only want one good one. I said, I'm not going to do another one because the labs, because if you screw up one, they're going to screw up two. And sometimes that confused Donald, because Donald had just come up with working for 30, 40 takes and everything. John was a great director. He was a director that had great vision, wonderful with actors, great with story. He was a two-point director.
That's incredible. Yeah, I need to mention that as a, filmmaker myself, came out of film school from Chicago. I was trained in cinematography as standard three to one shooting ratio. You allow for shooting the scene three times, and you take the best out of the three. Is that how you were taught, or is that customary to you?
I think we were about 8 to 1 shooting ratio,
that features. Wow. Amazing.
Who knows what it is now? It's all digital. They just keep shooting,
Yeah, exactly. That's another thing I'm curious about with you, Anthony.
You're curious about what?
Oh, pardon me. About with the advent of digital cinema, we obviously have now the Arri Alexa, the Blackmagic, Sony's cameras, etc. What are your thoughts on digital cinematography? Are you a fan of it? Do you use it much now, or are you opposed to it? What do you think in distinction to film?
I would still prefer to shoot on film.
Yeah.
But I did take the digital pretty quickly when it came out for a very simple reason. Very selfish reason is that, towards the end of the film, we were doing digital intermediates where you shot on the film, scan it into the computer, and then when it was all cut and edited and color corrected, you spew out a new negative, so it was still released on film. When it became totally digital, instead of going to the theater the next night,
yeah,
or lunchtime to see the previous day's work. You were given some sort of crappy compressed DVD, and you couldn't judge anything on that. You couldn't see film, but you couldn't even judge see composition.
Yeah.
So when visual came out and we started getting very good monitors on the set, I did like that because I'm seeing my dailies as I go.
Okay.
I would still sooner shoot on film, but also there's a very different way of filmmaking now. A lot of directors, you don't rehearse, you just keep shooting and keep shooting and keep shooting. And then they like to shoot open gates so they can reframe it as they go. You know, well, that's not movie making, I don't think. It's not, well, it is, but it isn't. It's just a different way of movie making. I mean, I try to still, my cinematographers, you know, go and see the movie. We have a big library in the school, DVD, a massive library. Take up movies over the weekend that are more than 25 years old, where you will see cinematography where the cinematographer had to get it right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you had to expose the negative correctly.
Right.
In post-production, you could make it a little lighter, a little darker, a little warmer, a little cooler. That's about it.
Sure.
In digital, you can do anything. You can change this, you can change that. Well, that's just a good start of filmmaking. But I still tell my guys, don't listen to that. You know, we can fix it in post. Put it properly in the camera and can't go wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I can see that with the true cinematographers yourself. You know, you know lighting. You push the edges of the composition and just the lighting tonalities and everything. Whereas so many, like I think you alluded to or references it now. So many films are just it's just coverage. It's just it's not even, you know, daring cinematography.
No, I mean, the movies are different than they were in the 70s and 80s. David Lee would cut the movie in the camera, quite frankly. I mean, there was very little way you could cut the movie up and the way you shot it, but nowadays you'll do different angles in every shot, and the movie is made in the cutting room.
Right, like TV. More so.
But, I mean, that's just another way a movie does it. You can't say it's bad, but it's not what I like.
Exactly. Well, you are, in my view, I mean, in what you've created and what you do create it and the way you work, it's simply you're more of an artist. You're more artistic and more of an auteur. Have you ever wanted to direct? Has there ever been a, you know, think, well, you know, essentially, or thought that you are directing and that you should have, you know, has there ever been that conflict in your mindset?
Well, I did direct one movie, but it wasn't. It's something that I wanted to do. I directed it, I didn't want to remain a director. I mean, I wanted to be a cinematographer. It's really hard being a director. I mean, you work for years on a project to bring you to the screen, you know.
Right.
And the great thing about a cinematographer is, I don't have a style. In fact, some cinematographers do have a style of their movies, but I shoot comedy, I shoot horror, I shoot anything, drama. Right.
Which I love that. You do. Diverse.
Well, the story should dictate the style. And it's also, interesting. You know, as a cinematographer, your two main jobs is the story, you're a slave to the story, and you are a slave to the director's vision. Because it's the director's vision, not the cinematographer's vision. And that director might have been working on it 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah.
On the screen, so you've got a strong idea of how the movie should look and feel. And hopefully you can take that vision and enhance it and make it better for him.
Right.
And, you know, so I've reached a point now in my career where I still do a movie every couple of years, but I only want to work with directors who are friends. It's so much easier. It's really hard making movies, you know.
Exactly. Well,
it's all about money.
Right. Well, you certainly, you know, make it look easy. I mean, your work is so prolific and outstanding. And, you know, I know I sound like a big fan, and I am. So just a lot of respect for you. Pleasure. Well, Anthony, I know your time is limited here. I could literally, you know, speak with you for the next year and just have endless questions. But I should, if I do that, I should probably, you know, pay for your class. But, you know, by the way, to remind listeners, speaking with legendary cinematographer Anthony Richmond, teaches at the New York Film Academy in Los Angeles, which is just amazing to me, the fact that you can actually get Anthony's expertise and learn from him, just simply amazing. Anthony, before I let you go here, and I thank you kindly for your, you know, kind generosity and your time, any advice you would give to aspiring cinematographers and filmmakers that, you know, maybe they're
just keep shooting. As much as you can. Just shoot as much as you can. The great thing about film school is, you know, you're going to, and especially this one, is we have major cinematographers working as teachers, all working cinematographers, and the thing is, each one of them is going to teach you something different. I may teach a class one way, the other guy may do it another way, and I don't believe, this is only my opinion, I don't believe there's any right way or wrong way in cinematography. I think there's this way and that way, and we teach it in such a way that it's for you to decide what's good for you.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Shoot as much as you can, because you'll learn from your mistakes.
It makes sense, as long as you have the technical aspect down, which I know you're a master at. You know, I had challenges.
The technical side of filmmaking is pretty easy.
You know? Interesting.
The stuff you do.
Yeah. Well, I had challenges with lighting. That was my, because math is not my strong suite, and I just had challenges with that.
That's really a cinematographer's main job, right?
Exactly, and you're just you're amazing at that. So, well, Anthony, it's a real pleasure. I want to please hold the line here before we go. Any final thing you'd like to tell our listeners or mention about what you have coming up or such before I let you go here?
Well, what's exciting is I've just been asked to shoot a remake of Jean-Luc Godard's Alphaville.
Oh my gosh!
And the script, I'm going to tell you, is absolutely fantastic.
And this is by Godard.
He's not doing it.
Okay.
He's another director, but I mean, the thing is they managed to get the rights from Penelope Plus and Godard.
Wow.
And it doesn't change Godard's movie. It goes a little deeper into each of the characters. And what we would do is, like he used Paris as the Other Planet in 1967, or 66 when he made that movie, we would use Prague, the other side, the back streets of Prague, you know, the sort of prominent here of Prague.
Yeah, canals and
just do that. And the script is exciting, and I'm just hoping they can get the money. So we'll see.
Well, that's exciting. You know, as big Godard fan as well, that's definitely, I will have to see that and re-see many of your amazing works you've done. Anthony, thank you. Bruce with Hollywood Sentinel, speaking with Anthony Richmond, cinematographer extraordinaire. Anthony, please hold the line. We'll be right back. And folks, check back with us often. Thank you.
Thank you.